This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
All right, let's turn our attention now to Unit 4, The Church Sets Standards. And in this particular unit, we're going to look at a variety of things. We're going to begin by talking about the early Christian apologists and how they helped begin to refine the faith as they tried to defend against these accusations that were brought against the Christian church. We'll also look at some of the ancient heresies that they had to deal with, which raised the question of authority that the church could not escape. In Unit 3, when we looked at the persecutions, we're really talking about attacks upon the Christian church from without. Here we're going to look more at attacks from within when we get to the heresies, which were just as serious and could be just as subversive of the vital life of the church as outward persecution would. But I want to focus our attention at the beginning by talking about that body of literature known as the apologetic works and the individuals who in the early years tried to defend the faith. And we really can talk about these Christian apologists between the second and the fifth centuries. We've looked at the second century Greek apologists, the early individuals. We've talked about them just a little bit during the period of the apostolic fathers, but there are many later apologists, even after Constantine will become the emperor, because pagan practice was still tolerated. There still were a lot of pagans that came out openly against Christianity, and so Christians were continuing to give an answer for their faith even though the persecutions had ceased. In the Greek tradition, this idea of apology is a speech offered by an accused in a judicial proceeding, and that is giving an answer. Many of the works of the number of these individuals are lost to us, unfortunately, but where we do have bits and pieces of testimony to it, we can at least see what they were trying to do. And several of the treatises offered by these apologists were actually presented to the emperors. The most well-known of the second century apologists would certainly be Justin Martyr, and given that title because of his own martyrdom, this intellectual Justin, this philosopher who was converted to Christianity, tells a story of how an old Christian man shared the gospel with him, and he became a believer and used his intellectual background then to help him defend the faith. Born in Syrian Palestine near the ancient city of Shechem, he had quite an intellectual journey as he was trained in the philosophy of the Stoics and Platonic studies. And after he is converted, he moves to the city of Rome and begins a teaching ministry and trying to give explanations for Christianity. He was known to debate publicly pagan philosophers and began to deal with some of the Christian heresies also. So he was dealing not only with pagan criticisms but the internal debates within the church. He disputed with some of the Jews that had leveled criticism against the church also. So here was someone who saw his calling in life really to defend Christianity from all attacks. And he even was involved with making appeals to the Roman government and calling it to cease from its unjust persecution of Christians. Eventually, though, he is going to be beheaded in Rome and give that ultimate testimony for his faith. But in his writings, we will see how he will argue for Christianity based upon the Old Testament writings, the prophecies that point to Christ, the miracles that we see in the Word of God, and the superiority of Christian ethics. You can see his Stoic background evidence there, that morality was a big deal, and he argued that that the Christians were superior in that area. Now, and the first apology was actually addressed to Antoninus Pius, a Roman emperor, as he appeals to fairness for Christians who should not be judged based on the slander and irrational hatred which is leveled against believers. He defended Christian beliefs and their moral lives, and talked about how really the highest form of philosophical thought is found among the Christians. And he began to suggest that the wisdom of Christ may even have been evidenced in the best thinking of pagan ideas, this logos that enlightens every man, and looking for ways that he could see the presence of wisdom and some ideas that were not inconsistent with Christianity, even among some of the pagan philosophers. And we'll talk about the uniqueness of his approach. Now, in the second apology was kind of a follow-up to this first one. This was on the occasion when three Christians were beheaded. And so he actually addresses this to the Roman Senate and talks about how unjust this is. He gives an answer to some of the slander that is brought against the faith, pointing to the courageous action of these believers, and also talks about the meaning of suffering in the second apology. So these first two works addressed first to the emperor and to the Roman Senate. So he's stepping right into the middle of the fray and appealing to the political authorities. Probably his most well-known work is probably the dialogue with Trypho. Rather fascinating piece that we have, and where he has this discussion with this Jewish philosopher, and talking about the truth of the scriptures and the reality of the fulfillment of the Old Testament in the person of Christ, as he gives his interpretation of the Old Testament and the Mosaic Law. And it purports to be this dialogue between Justin Martyr and Trypho, the Jew. And it's an early evidence of an appeal to Jews to consider Christianity at this point in time. Now, Against Heresies, we know, and Against Marcion are two works that we know he penned, but both of them, unfortunately, are lost. Another illustrations of those we read about in the writings of others. Irenaeus actually used Against Marcion in his well-known piece Against Heresies. He will quote from that and use some of the arguments that Justin Martyr would use, but those are gone with the wind, if you would. When we consider his particular approach to the apologetic task, his philosophical background is very important to consider. One can see the Platonic influence and his focus on God's transcendence and the universal moral law, and this notion that the wisdom of God can be seen in some of the writings of these philosophers. And something that maybe we're a bit uncomfortable with, but he was trying to find common ground, if you would, with pagan thought. In Justin Martyr's approach in his apologetics, part of the unique angle that he took on this was understanding the this logos, what he called the logos spermatikos, the seed of the word, not only had given wisdom to Moses, who produced the Torah, the great law of God, Moses had in turn influenced the Greek philosophers, that they were aware of his writings, but the Logos also had directly influenced the Greek philosophers. The seed of the Logos, which is in every man. And so Justin was willing to say that these pagan philosophers perhaps had some of the wisdom of God within them and in their writings. And he was trying to see where Greek philosophy could overlap with Christian thinking. And this was kind of his approach at this point. Kind of a unique approach to him. He's very orthodox, though, in his Christology and his understanding of the person of Christ, as he gave intelligent arguments for Christianity. Again, looking at prophecy and miracles, the fulfillment of these things in Christ, eventually being scourged and beheaded. and one of the martyrs of the church. When we talk about these apologetic works, there are two different categories of writings that are referred to. And one of them is a category called the Adversus Judaeus. That is, those works that were attempting to defend the faith against Jewish attacks, defending Christianity from the Old Testament. Matthew figures very eminently in this, as they pointed to the fulfillment of prophecy, which Matthew seems to underscore in his writings. Remember the early suggestion that perhaps Matthew may have been written in Hebrew. Stephen's speech in the book of Acts is filled with allusions to the Old Testament and how Christ is genuinely the Messiah. And in the book of Galatians, in the controversy with the Judaizing Christians, also this notion of how the Old Testament fulfilled in the New Testament. Now, the Epistle of Barnabas in the second century, which we have numbered among the writings of the Apostolic Fathers, also is one of these pieces which appears to have been addressed to Jewish readers. And its great emphasis on how the sacrifices in the Old Testament were fulfilled in Christ. It points to the spiritual reality of circumcision of the heart as a fulfillment of circumcision in the flesh in the Old Testament. And the Epistle of Barnabas does use the methodology of allegory, looking at how there may be pictures in the Old Testament which prefigure the person of Christ. Now, this dialogue with Trypho, the Jew, that we looked at would also fit into this category. And this supposed conversation, which appears to be a record, the way it's presented is an actual debate among this Justin Martyr and this intellectual Jew. And he argues there for correctly understanding and interpreting the Old Testament, and pointing to many of the types in the Scriptures, and how Christianity is now the true Israel, which the Old Testament points to. There are other polemical tracts we find in Tertullian and Augustine, and you see that they are still dealing with Jewish readers and Jewish criticisms of the faith, and again, Messianic prophecy and its fulfillment we see evidenced in their writings. And those writings, by the way, in Tertullian and Augustine would be in Latin, so that would be more the western part of the church, and so Jews and some of those Greek communities were still in focus there, and the Christians had a sense of giving an answer and appealing to these Jews to consider Christianity. So in this time when we're talking about the development of the Christian church and what was taking place, you know, the Jews are still present. The Jews are still present, and the church is still concerned about both defending and appealing to them to consider Christianity. One of the approaches that was taken in considering addressing the Jews was not only focusing in on the messianism, that is this idea of the suffering and the death of Christ, and its proof from both the Psalms and, say, the book of Isaiah, but also pointing to the law. And we find in some of these writings the earliest distinctions made between the moral and ceremonial law, something we talk about sometimes, of what parts of the law are applicable to the New Testament church, which parts aren't. Obviously, that distinction was unknown to Judaism, but the Christians were beginning in the early centuries to have to make a distinction. All right, the Old Testament is our book too. What parts of it are going to be directly relevant to the ongoing Christian church, and what parts of it were unique to the ancient Jewish tradition? And so that distinction was made. And the whole role of the Gentiles, kind of some interesting things that emerge here. You know, they're pretty straightforward about the fact that, you know, God has rejected the Jews as God's chosen people. We are now the new chosen sons of God. And as they looked at the Old Testament, one of the techniques that they used is they looked at the stories of in the Old Testament, particularly in Genesis, about the number of times where it seemed like God seemed to favor the younger brother over the older brother. And they saw in that an allegory of Old Testament Israel and the New Testament church. Looking at the relationship of Isaac and Ishmael, it was the younger son, later born, that God blessed. Jacob and Esau, it was Jacob, the younger, who was the received the covenant, and Joseph and his brothers. And they pointed to these stories and say, see, God is blessing the younger. And they saw that as a picture foretelling God's covenant with the church. All right, one of the questions is, who are the intended readers, of this material? Was it just Jewish readers? Was it an attempt to encourage, Gentile converts too? Because obviously the Old Testament meant a lot to them, and it was the primary text that they continued to have as the New Testament books are being collected. So, we really don't know the answer to that. Certainly it appears that it was specifically addressed to some Jews, but it probably was considered very valuable to Gentile readers also. But we do know that some of their writings were specifically addressed to pagan criticisms. Pagans viewed Christianity as politically dangerous, socially offensive, and intellectually absurd. And these apologists believed that they were called to defend the church from popular violence and political repression and by preserving the credibility of the mission work of the church. And they were called to give an account for these things. Well, we see evidence initially in some of this in the New Testament itself. Peter talks about the importance of being ready to give a defense for the faith. We see it throughout the book of Acts, and especially in Paul's interaction with the Greeks there as he's trying to give testimony to the faith. We've looked at it in the second century. In these early apologists, but also as we move later, we see some other well-known works. Among these Latin apologies, Tertullian has left us his apology. We've got this another one of these dialogue type of apologetic works, the Octavius of Minucius Felix, Origen against Celsus, where he addresses this pagan by name. And the arguments that he had brought against Christianity, answering them point by point. And then ultimately, probably the great final apologetic work of the ancient church would be the City of God itself. And those most difficult parts of the City of God to read really are the portions where Augustine is going into great detail answering some of the pagan philosophers. And it becomes painfully clear that he had an enormous grasp of all these ideas. The fact that he was converted a little bit later on as a young man, and that he had studied this for all of his life up until that point, he could go chapter by chapter, line by line, where these pagan criticisms were, and kind of gives the definitive answer of the ancient church to so many of those issues. But here are some works that became known in the church and that were most helpful. Tertullian gets on board with this in arguing for toleration of Christians and the fact that they really are good citizens, and they ought not to be attacked in these ways. Tertullian was a lawyer by profession, it appears, was a layman, a teacher in North Africa, in close to Carthage. And he's left us multitudes of works. Sometimes he is called the great theologian of the Western Church in the early centuries, and began to give some early expositions on the doctrine of the Trinity. He is a fascinating individual, and I'd suggest if you want to consider reading Tertullian and doing your biography on him, he would certainly be worthwhile. He is kind of an enigma in many ways, which will unfold as I talk some more about him, but he certainly got into the foray over defending the faith. Now this Octavius of Minucius Felix is the discussion between a Christian named Octavius with a pagan named Caecilius. And we really don't know who this individual Minucius Felix is, but usually when you read that document, we do have a collection of the a text of the entire thing. It will be listed as the Octavius of Minucius Felix, even though we really don't know who this writer is. And he goes into these different aspects of defending the faith based on the immortality that Christianity offered, the great ethical standards of the faith. He attacks many of the pagan myths and argues for the great monotheistic religion of Christianity. Now, Origins Against Celsus, this is a pagan work that we only have knowledge about because Origen cites it extensively in his reaction to it. But Celsus was a pagan philosopher who had given some detailed critique of Christianity that Origen will address there. So these be a number of works if you have an interest in looking what were Christians saying back to the pagans of that day. Some very articulate thinking by believers. Now, part of the apologetic methodology began to go on the aggressive stance. Rather than just standing fast and rebutting every new accusation that came out against the Christians, they began to go on the offensive and really go after the pagan myths and pagan society as they attacked these things. Many argued, like Justin Marr, that look, Christianity is really consistent with the best of classical thinking. And they had this sense that, many of them did, that there are some truths that we can find in the pagan philosopher, if all truth is God's truth, and they say some things that are worthwhile, and we can point to some common ground there. And again, trying to appeal to pagan thinking, they saw this as a legitimate way to get their foot in the door, apologetically, if you would. They used some of the arguments that old arguments from Hellenistic Judaism, and just as there had been a tradition of the Jews arguing for the legitimacy of the Jewish faith in the context of Hellenism, the Christians picked up on some of that evidence that they were very aware of this body of literature and. They could utilize some of that for their purposes. And they didn't hesitate to feed into some of the cultural critique that existed within the Greco-Roman context of the mythology anyway. Since many of the intellectuals questioned a lot of this stuff, they found that was some common ground with these pagans also. Denying the criminal behavior and argued that there was an absence of evidence in these things. So we worship the one true God, not these popular gods. These sacrifices are superfluous. You know, any God that really exists doesn't need these kinds of sacrifices. Christians are good citizens. They should not be prosecuted for only having the name of Christian. This is against Roman law. This is not novelty. The ancient Jewish faith is the foundation for this new Christian faith. And attacking popular religion. These images are unworthy of reverence. The moral perversity that was found in many of these pagan cults. And they ridicule the anthropomorphism and immorality in a lot of these classical myths. So they really tried to go for the jugular in some of these things, and not only sitting back and waiting for the accusations to come, really answering back forcefully. The big question that was raised by the thinkers at this period, how should we use pagan philosophy to defend the faith? Should we at all? And if so, how should we go about it? It does appear that in most instances, the apologists did value the philosophical tradition of their own culture. This was a part of the societies in which they lived. The educated were familiar with these concepts, and if we can use these things, why not? And so they tended to stress some of the similarities, with pagan ways of thinking, and the classical logos speculation was accommodated to Christianity. You know, when St. John pens his gospel and uses this idea of the logos, that was full of a lot of detailed information in the Greek mind. Now, John had to redefine it and fill it with new Christian content, but that was an immediate connection with Gentile readers when he talked about the logos. And likewise, these early Christian apologists tried to take that concept and then show how it could be understood in terms of the person of Christ himself. And we mentioned Justin's connection with the Logos. But Justin really was on one extreme end, I think, of this continuum about how we ought to utilize pagan philosophy, even suggesting at some points that those in ancient times that lived according to reason might indeed be saved. And this was more a cultural affirming stance, if you would. Now, he is definitely on one end of the continuum here, and not all of them would have gone that far, but he so believed that the wisdom of God had infiltrated thinking of the best of pagan philosophy that, you know, if they really lived according to the light that God had given them, maybe perhaps some of them, you know, were saved. Kind of a, what I call get inside the culture approach. Justin Martyr's perspective that the wisdom of God influenced the philosophers and certainly Moses. So they were simply repeating the great insights that Moses, too, had found in the law of God. Well, this was certainly not the only approach. Tertullian would be an example of someone on the other side of this discussion who put his emphasis on the dissimilarity with paganism. And he is the author of the famous little statement, "What does Jerusalem have to do with Athens?" And he pointed to a number of ways that, listen, Christian thinking is just absolutely incongruent with any kind of pagan ideas. And some of the very basic notions of pagan philosophy, such as matter being eternal. No, the Old Testament is very clear about that God created all things out of nothing. And, you know, these ideas are diametrically opposed. How can we say there's God's light in this in pagan thinking? Or the typical Greek idea of cyclical history. You know, that the matter is eternal and that these things will continue on in the cycle of life versus a distinctly Christian view. There will be a consummation of history, the return of Christ, and the final judgment. How can that be at all reconciled with a Christian vantage point? So what does Jerusalem have to do with Athens? Tertullian and others would point to the principle, touch not the unclean things. If these ideas are part of the kingdom of darkness and we ought to stay away from it. After all, the Greek philosophers are the patriarchs of the heretics, was one way that that was put. And we might describe this as a Christianity against culture approach. Now, that would be significant for us as we study the whole field of apologetics. Obviously, this discussion has not gone away. We talk about the tension between evidentialist approach to apologetics or presuppositional apologetics or a combination thereof. And even in ancient times, they struggled with where's the starting point? Do we look for common ground with them? And these were not easy answers. I will suggest to you long term, and we can talk about this now if you'd like to, that I think the person who had the keenest insight on so much of these things was St. Augustine himself. St. Augustine was more a both-and guy. And if you look at the City of God, he will quote some of the pagan philosophers favorably. And he will say, you know, they had some insights here. This is, we would agree with them on this. This is right. But then he'll be really brutal with them when they say things that are completely inconsistent with Christianity. And you find kind of that balance in St. Augustine. Maybe he was so familiar with this tension in the ancient church, and he realized maybe this is a false dichotomy. Maybe there is a bit of truth in both of that. both of these things, and this was kind of where he ended up in the city of God. But it is an age-old question that we've got to continue to deal with. And even on a practical level, I think in our churches, we often ask ourselves, where do we accommodate our ministries in the church to the demands of and the context of culture? Where do we maintain our distinctiveness, you know, uniquely as Christians? And where are the lines to be drawn? But among the apologists, they at least were very assertive about these things, didn't sit back and decided to take on pagan thought and to give an answer for the faith as they felt like God would have them to do. Yeah, Tertullian was in the 2nd century. So they were both North African fathers, though. That's a good question because Augustine would have been very familiar with Tertullian's writings because he would have been, in the ancient, early periods, the most preeminent. Yes, yeah, roughly. Mm-hmm. And some of the best theology really was produced by the North Africans in the ancient church. No question about that. Thomas Oden has made that argument in a recent book about the African history of the Western church and kind of the kernel of the best theology came forth there. All right. Let me begin here a little bit of our time looking at some of these different heretical groups that attack the church from within. Some of this you're going to be more familiar with than others. Most of us, because of the ongoing discussions, even in our own culture, are very aware of Gnosticism. We perhaps have heard of Marcion. He was an infamous heretic in the old church. Monarchianism. There are still some contemporary advocates of some of these ideas among us. And Montanism, interestingly, still would have some contemporary advocates in a certain vein also. So a lot of this stuff is more contemporary than you might realize. But I dare say probably the group you've never heard of before, most of you, is the Ebionites. Maybe you have. We do have a few little pieces from this particular movement, the Gospel of the Ebionites and the Gospel of the Hebrews. Some of these apocryphal Gospels that gave a particular interpretation of the life and ministry of Jesus that the majority of the church considered heretical. So let me tell you a little bit about the Ebionites. Now the word Ebionite is a word that's translated from the Aramaic, which basically means the poor. And these were some early Jewish Christians. This movement originated in Palestine, and the earliest reference to it is in Irenaeus in the 2nd century. He talks about the Ebionites in his work Against Heresies. But having originated in Palestine, there were some Ebionites that had spread to Asia Minor. So there were a number of these communities around. These were Jewish Christians and emphasized circumcision, the key place of the city of Jerusalem itself, the ongoing relevance of the Mosaic Law, the Gospel of Matthew to them in Hebrew was so important. They were not very fond of St. Paul and didn't see much relevance to his writings. In fact, they considered him an apostate because he appeared in his writings to reject the Jewish law. They acknowledged Jesus as the Messiah and said that the Spirit of God had come upon Jesus at his baptism. So among the Ebionites, Jesus was a prophet, if you would, who was an enlightened one, but certainly not equal to God the Father. Some of the Ebionites rejected the idea of the virgin birth and were very connected to this idea of an imminent return of Christ in a millennium, in a golden era. But from these two little epistles, we get an idea of some of the things that they tended to emphasize. In the Gospel of the Hebrews, for example, who is the apostle that becomes very prominent in the retelling of the story of Jesus and the leader of the church? But it's James. In fact, James becomes the first eyewitness of the resurrection, and it is James, the brother of Christ, who participates in the Last Supper, which we have no, in the authentic Gospels, we have no reference to that necessarily. But because Jerusalem is central, the law is central, James, a brother of Jesus, the great leader of the Jewish church, becomes the most important apostle. Not Peter and Paul, but James. And so the early church had to deal with this particular group, the Ebionites. And it will continue on into the 3rd and 4th century. We'll find references in some of the later fathers to these groups, but eventually this particular sect will just die out, and you no longer hear about it later on. It doesn't figure prominently in the story of the church, but at least it's one of these little sects that was bothersome that the church had to deal with. Probably the bigger one that we would all be familiar with and has had such a huge reinvigoration in recent years is Gnosticism. I think coming on the scene as a result of the findings at Nag Hammadi in the 19th century, and these codices of Egyptian Coptic text of Gnostic Gospels, which kind of unfolded the bigger picture of what ancient Gnosticism was. For years and years, all we really knew about ancient Gnosticism was from the writings of the fathers, who quoted from some of these Gnostic Gospels and talked about some of these leaders and then responded to that. But with the find at Nag Hammadi in Egypt of these Gnostic texts, which have been translated, and you can buy copies of the Nag Hammadi library at your neighborhood bookstore, and the popularization of a number of these Gnostic Gospels. Probably the most well-known one would be the Gospel of Thomas, which Elaine Pagels at Princeton University has helped popularize that one. And you've got Bart Ehrman at Chapel Hill, who's kind of big into revisiting some of these Gnostic documents. And in some of the liberal and agnostic aspects of our society today, you've got these scholars who are kind of raising the question, well, who's to say that the ancient church actually picked the authentic Gospels? Maybe some of these Gnostic Gospels were the true testimony about Jesus. And a lot of the Gnostic Gospels have kind of a New Age-ish feel to them. If you read some of them, they're rather bizarre, and there's a lot of scholars like to point out in terms of our understanding of Gnosticism in light of the Nag Hammadi finds that Gnosticism is really worse than we thought, more bizarre as we've gotten a fuller view of these kinds of things. So we have a sense of what Gnosticism really was. It was a movement which really does not take a firm root on the fringes of the church till later in the second century. So when we talk about this collection of ideas known as Gnosticism, we're really talking about more the second century and beyond. Scholars usually talk about proto-Gnostic ideas in the first century. And it does appear that even within the pages of the New Testament that there are some inferences that they were beginning to be challenged by some Gnostic-like ideas. But Gnosticism, more a collection of ideas than an organization. So it existed both outside the church and within the church. And we use the term Christian Gnosticism for these fringe groups of the church which were using some of these additional Gospels and purporting to teach their followers, you know, the real truth about who Jesus is. And this caused quite a problem for the church leaders. They had to really work hard to stamp this out, and a lot of the fathers wrote against Gnosticism, very threatening. And so these Gnostic Gospels were, as they are typically called today, the secret Gospels, you know, as though they were kind of discovered and nobody ever knew about these things. Well, Christians have have known about the Gnostic Gospels since ancient times. There's nothing secret about these things that have been hidden. We've known about them, but they have drawn new attention, again, as an attempt to critique Christianity and the authentic faith. All right, what do we know of the basic parameters of Gnosticism? Again, think of it as not an organized movement or an institution, but a set of ideas. And one of the things that's very clear is you read the Gnostic text. While there's some general themes that I'm going to lay out here for you, these writings are very diverse. And most of these different Gnostic groups are individually claiming to have the secret knowledge themselves. All right, the Greek word gnosis, mystical knowledge reserved for the enlightened, and the secret knowledge that they could bring to their followers is the key to salvation. And this salvation concerns the escape from this evil material world. And the eternal spirit is trapped in the body, which is a prison. And this basic Greek dualism, that the spirit is good, the body is evil, permeated all Gnostic thinking and had dramatic ramifications for how one viewed, for example, the person of Christ and the creation. And so it began to cut at the very root of what it meant to be Christian because of this basic dualistic presupposition that only the spirit and the spiritual is good, and the body and material things are those things that we need to shun. All right, what are the implications of that for theories about the origin of the world and the origin of matter, creation, if you would? If all reality is spiritual, how did some of the Gnostics try to explain how the material world came into existence? One of the ways that they describe the great God, this spiritual entity, all-powerful over all things, is they described him as the Father of Light. And the Father of Light really had no plans to create this material world, but these spiritual beings, these angelic beings that he created, one of them, they were called the Aeons in some of the Gnostic texts, fell away created this material world. And in these material beings, there were bits of spirit that were within these material things and human beings. And salvation in the Gnostic framework then was to be released from the body by gnosis, a spark of divinity within the human body, and where the spirit is imprisoned. One way to think about this, if you look at the Father of Light, and here's Earth, with this series of aeons, or angelic beings. Sometimes the Gnostics would talk about them being forms of angels. That there was, if you would, a thinning out of the divine being in these spiritual beings. And finally, one of them, pretty far down the chain from the Father of Light, fell and created the material world, where the bits of spirit are trapped then inside the body. And what the way Gnostics understood then what the salvation was all about is how they might escape from this bondage to the body and be reunited with the Father of Light. And all the different Gnostic sects were all about trying to give the answer to how we might find the secret knowledge that we can be reunited with the Great One and the Great Spirit. So it was kind of a complex, picture of this kind of thing. But generally, they all kind of felt this this way. And the goal then was to break through these different spheres and be reunited back with the pleroma or fullness. That's another expression that was used for the Father of light is the pleroma, or the fullness. Sometimes they would just use the term the one. There are a number of different ways they described God, if you would. And so what we need to do is to break through these different spheres. Now, who's going to bring us the message? Well, in Gnostic theology, if you would, the Savior, the spiritual messenger that would come to come and awaken people from the dream as they're asleep within their bodies, he will come to remind them who they really are. You really are heavenly beings, and I'm bringing to you the secret knowledge. And in Christian Gnosticism, the messenger is Christ himself. And he is the one that will remind them and bring the knowledge of salvation. Well, this causes quite a problem if you're trying to meld together these Greek Gnostic ideas and Christianity. Because the Christian church had some very distinctive ideas about who Jesus was as he walked upon the earth in a physical body. And this would cause problem for Gnostic thinking. So the Gnostics got kind of creative in their understanding of who Jesus really was. For if he is from heaven, he certainly can only be a pure spirit. But if we accept the premise that the body and all matter is evil, therefore, this Jesus of Nazareth could not have had a real human body. So some of the suggestions that the Gnostic groups put forward is this idea that really Christ's body was just a ghost or a phantom. It had no real substance to it. It just appeared to be human. Some even began to draw a distinction between a heavenly Christ and an earthly Jesus, another explanation that was given, and that the heavenly Christ left the earthly Jesus before he went to the cross, because certainly the divine messenger could not die. Most of them denied the virgin birth of Christ. Many of them in their accounts in these Gospels about the ministry of Jesus, Jesus would just appear on the scene. No story of his infancy and his human birth. Now, the fathers talked about collectively this kind of heresy as docetism, from the Greek word dokeo, which means to seem or to appear, that Christ only seemed to have a human body, that he was a pure spiritual being. And this is what the term docetism refers to, or the docetic heresy. So this was kind of a comprehensive term that was used for a number of different movements. Now, their answer to life on earth went into a couple of different veins. One answer that the Gnostics gave to, all right, if the goal of life is to escape from this material world and be reunited with the One, to awaken from the dream, if the body is in the prison of the spirit, what we need to do during our time on earth is to control our passions. And some were very extreme ascetics, denying the body all human desires. And this is what life in the Gnostic communities should be about, emphasizing celibacy and abstaining from certain foods and really buffeting the body and restraining all these human desires. The flip side was some of the Gnostics argued in the opposite direction that, hey, if the body really is evil and really doesn't matter anyway, who cares how you use it? And, you know, some of the Greeks were attracted to this version of Gnosticism. So with general concepts of creation in Christ gave some different answers to the way Gnostics ought to live life on this planet. And again, I think there are a few evidences within the scriptures themselves to some early Gnostic-like ideas that the apostles had to deal with. And I'll just make reference to a few of those because I think you'll sense that there's a clear connection here because they sound so similar to what some of these Gnostic leaders were advocating. And let me read from Colossians, for example. And I think you'll sense Paul may very well have had in mind here as he was dealing with some of these ideas. In Colossians chapter 2, beginning with verse 18, particularly if you keep in mind this more ascetic version of Gnosticism. Because remember, he's writing to Greeks. There probably were some Jews in the church at Colossae. There were typically in a lot of these Gentile areas, but predominantly a Gentile congregation. And here's what he writes to them. Let no one keep defrauding you of your prize by delighting in self-abasement and the worship of angels. May very well be pointing to this kind of a Gnostic framework. Taking his stand on visions he has seen inflated without cause by a fleshly mind, and not holding fast to the head, from whom the entire body, being supplied and held together by the joints and ligaments, grows with a growth which is from God. And if you have died with Christ to the elementary principles of the world, why, as if you were living in the world, do you submit yourself to decrees such as don't handle, don't taste, don't touch? All of these things refer to those destined to perish with the using in accordance with the commandments and teachings of men. These are matters which have, to be sure, the appearance of wisdom in self-made religion and self-abasement and severe treatment of the body, but are of no value against fleshly indulgence. So many point to this passage in Colossians may be one place where you find an inference there. And let me just read one from the pastoral epistles also. In 2 Timothy. In 1 Timothy, chapter 1. In verses 3 to 7, it says, "For I urged you upon my departure from Macedonia to remain on at Ephesus in order that you may teach and instruct certain men not to teach strange doctrines, nor to pay attention to myths and endless genealogies which give rise to certain speculation, rather than furthering the administration of God, which is by faith." And then over in chapter 4, the first few verses. "But the Spirit explicitly says that in later times some will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons, by means of hypocrisy of liars seared in their own conscience as with a branding iron, men who forbid marriage and advocate abstaining from foods which God has created to be gratefully shared in by those who believe and know the truth. For everything God created is good, nothing to be rejected if it is received with gratitude." And probably the passage that's most well known there in 1 John, where John explicitly says in chapters 4 and 5 that anyone who denies that Jesus has come in the flesh is not of God. And where he puts the focus on the flesh and blood of Jesus, implying that there are some that are beginning to deny that Jesus had a real fleshly body. Sounds rather Gnostic. And did John encounter these ideas? Maybe, maybe not. But it appears that Gnostic thinking does seem appropriate to what's taking place here. All right. Let me pause it. At this point, see if you have any questions or comments about Gnosticism.
Tertullian or Origen or one of them pretty soundly refute Gnosticism in one of their writings.
Well, Irenaeus in Against Heresies is pretty much fully.
Really, just attacks it and breaks
yes.
it down and pretty soundly.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Right?
Yep. And they were very brutal, you might say, in their attacks on Gnosticism.
Intellectually.
Yes. And this is, things that they were seeing taking place again on the fringes of the church. And so this was something that they were convinced they had to address head on and immediately.
Uh huh.
Yeah. Right. In the ancient Greek thinking, the logos concept had to do with this idea of the universal mind or wisdom of which we all partake as human beings. And the Greeks used this in a variety of ways to talk about this universal mind and wisdom. And so they were very familiar with this in Greek philosophical writings. And so when John uses this and refers to Christ with that language, he is implying here, you want to know where all wisdom is found? It's found in the person of Jesus Christ. So he takes a pagan concept and fills it with new content. And one of the ways that I think we sometimes can justify our use of distinctive terminology, which is not biblical in origin, is seeing a precedent for this in John in ways that sometimes terminology of their culture was used and filled with Christian content. Sometimes people say, well, why should we use the word Trinity? It's not in the Bible. Well, it was a word that was coined to describe some biblical truths. And just because it's a word that we don't find in the pages of Scripture doesn't mean that we can't use a term that is helpful to us in describing some biblical truth. And this is apparently what John did. And again, if you think about him living up close to the end of the first century, if among any of the apostles, he would have been aware of some of these Gnostic ideas that were circulating. And this logos idea that was being used by the Gnostics also. And then he was able to show how Christ is the embodiment. And the Word became flesh. Notice how he emphasizes that. The Word became flesh. And John is one that emphasizes in his first epistle, we have seen him, we have touched him. This was real. This is not, an illusion. And you could see where some teachers that like to draw a crowd could see, well, I think some of these teachings of Jesus could fit pretty well. And you have these kind of hybrid theologies incorporating some Gnostic ideas, some Christian ideas. Like we see with some of the, I call them more New Age-ish kind of philosophy and theologies today. There'll be some parts of it that sound a little bit Christian and ideas here and there, and then mix other ideas with it. And this apparently is what the Gnostics were doing at this time. They're trying to take some of the basic gospel concepts but then twist them to their own purposes.
Maybe you said it and I missed it. How far back does Gnosticism
begin? Most scholars talk about the emergence of full-blown Gnosticism 2nd century. But then use the term proto-Gnosticism to talk about some of the ideas in the late first century that appeared to have been circulating. But we really don't find Gnostic texts till the 2nd century, which is one of the arguments that the fathers used for these Gospels. Well, how could this have been the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Bartholomew, the Gospel of Thomas? How can you say these men wrote that? They don't show up till the 2nd century. These could not have been authentic Gospels. We can trace Matthew, Mark, and Luke back to the times of the apostles. And so the historical time frame was one of the key ways that they argued about the authentic Gospels.
This has no connection to Greek antiquity. I've always thought it.
Well, in terms of some of the ideas, I think you can see some connections there, because it emerged in the great Greco-Roman milieu, and where some of these ideas of particularly the spirit body dualistic notion, which was common among in Platonic thought, for example, was something that was just kind of a common notion that people would have had, at least among intellectuals. So you can see some roots there. But in terms of a distinctive movement, yeah, you're talking about later 2nd century. Much like we'll talk about later Neoplatonism. Those ideas, you can say, oh yeah, you can really see some of this in Plato in the 4th century BC, but Neoplatonism was a distinct new movement into the 3rd and 4th century that Augustine dealt with.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.